All right, let's explore the notes from Brother John's message Sunday night, Fruit That Produces. It certainly gave us a lot to think about: urgency, prophecy, personal responsibility.
It really did. And our task here, I think, is to pull out the core themes, understand what it means to be, well, a fruitful steward, a prepared believer,
yep,
especially now.
Yes, especially now. And the source mentioned some context too, right? Operation Christmas Child, the memory verse, women's fellowship, prayer needs, Karen Pike's knee, Margaret being sick, important grounding.
Absolutely. Community context matters. But Brother John, he jumped right into the bigger picture, current events.
He did. He started by noting Islam as the fastest growing religion globally.
And he made a specific point, didn't he? Attributing some of that growth not just to demographics, but to violent means in certain regions.
That definitely set a serious tone. Vigilance, like you said.
And it connected immediately to persecution. He brought up Revelation 20, verse 4.
Ah, the souls beheaded for their witness to Jesus. A powerful, sobering image.
It is. And then there was that quote from the sermon notes.
Oh, right. If we are not being persecuted, then we're not truly walking in the faith.
Yep.
That's challenging. How do we understand that? Especially if we're not facing, you know, physical violence.
That's a key question. I think the sermon framed persecution maybe more broadly. It's about the cost of following Christ authentically.
Meaning, if our faith changes how we live, how we speak, there will be friction.
Some kind of friction, yes. Rejection, maybe misunderstanding, cultural pushback. The point seemed to be that if there's zero friction, perhaps we're blending in too much. It might not be beheading, but it's a call to a level of commitment that does have a cost. Social, maybe even.
Economic.
Yeah.
Which he got into next.
Exactly. The mark of the beast.
Not just a literal mark, the sermon emphasized, but a symbol of ultimate loyalty to the Antichrist.
And the consequence. Total economic exclusion if you refuse. You can't buy or sell.
And here's where it felt very current. The connection he drew between that ancient prophecy and, well, today's digital world.
Right. Digital currency, crypto. He argued this makes a one-world currency, that kind of centralized control needed for the Antichrist, far more possible now than ever before.
Why is that digital shift so significant in this context?
It's about control and traceability. Physical cash is harder to track globally, but digital money, especially with centralized ledgers.
Instantaneous, everywhere, complete oversight.
Precisely. The technology provides a mechanism for that kind of global economic control described in Revelation, something technically almost impossible just a generation ago.
So events are potentially aligning. The Bible talks about things happening in rapid succession, like birth pains, 1 Thessalonians.
Chapter 5, verses 3 and 4, yes.
The message stressed that we as believers are expected to know this, to be well-versed.
We shouldn't be caught off guard. The day the Lord comes as a thief in the night, but Paul says we are not in darkness, so that day shouldn't surprise us like a thief.
The real danger isn't just being surprised by world events, but being found unprepared, spiritually.
And hearing those words, Matthew 7:23, I never knew you. That's the ultimate fear.
Which leads perfectly into the second major part of the message.
Right.
The internal check. How do we make sure our faith is real, that it's producing actual fruit?
The command was clear, repeated, examine yourselves. He cited 1 Corinthians 11:27 about taking communion unworthily and 2 Corinthians 13:5.
Test yourselves to see if you are in the faith.
Exactly. A direct command.
And this goes way beyond just, you know, showing up on Sunday or getting baptized years ago. What's the real test, according to the sermon?
He pointed straight to the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:6.
Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness.
That hunger, that deep ongoing desire for God's ways, his holiness. That's the indicator. Is that spiritual appetite real in you? Is it growing?
To really grasp that, he explained some key theological ideas. Let's touch on those. First, justification.
Right. He defined it as our legal standing before God, declared innocent, not because of what we've done, but because of Christ's sacrifice. It's about imputed righteousness.
Imputed. That word's important. Explain that a bit more.
Impute means to attribute or credit something to someone. So God credits Christ's perfect righteousness to us. Legally, he sees us as righteous because of Jesus. It's a completed action. Done.
Okay, so justification is God's act declaring us righteous. What follows?
Justification makes the Holy Spirit available to us in a new way to begin the work of sanctification.
Sanctification, that's the process.
That's the ongoing process. Becoming holy, being set apart, growing more like Christ in our actual lives, day by day. It's the evidence, really, that the justification was genuine. It's cooperative, God works, and we respond.
So internal reality, established, justified, then sanctified.
Yeah.
Now the external proof, the action. That took us to Matthew 25.
The parable of the talents, yes. A very serious story about Christ's return and our accountability.
And he pointed out the word used for servant, doulos.
Bond servant, not just an employee, someone owned, bound in service. It implies a deep relationship, immense trust from the master.
And the trust was huge, considering what a talent was worth. The note said one talent was like 20 years' wages.
Roughly, yes. Maybe $600,000 or more in today's terms. So the master wasn't handing out pocket change. He entrusted them with significant wealth, millions potentially.
Which really drives home the idea of stewardship today, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We're stewards of everything God gives us, not just money, but time, skills, opportunities, relationships, everything.
The sermon put it bluntly. Resources reveal the heart. How you handle what you're given shows what you truly value.
And notice how the talents were given to each according to his own ability.
That stood out to me, too. It implies God knows what we can handle.
It does. It's wisdom and grace. The five-talent person isn't bored. The one-talent person isn't crushed by overwhelming responsibility. God matches the task to the capacity he's given.
So how did they respond? The faithful ones, the five-talent and two-talent servants.
Immediately. They went right to work, invested, and doubled what they were given.
The message there seems clear. Growth. Action. We're meant to be increasing, becoming better stewards today than we were yesterday.
Then you have the contrast. The unfaithful servant.
He wasn't idle, exactly. He was busy digging a hole.
Busy body, but with no fruit, as the notes put it. Effort expended, but only to hide, to preserve, not to multiply. And why?
Fear. He says it plainly. I was afraid.
And the sermon drew a direct line from that fear, that hiding, to us today.
Refusing to share the gospel. Or not using the gifts God gave you because you're afraid of what people might think.
Functionally, it's the same as burying the talent. It's letting fear paralyze the potential for fruitfulness.
It all comes to a head when the master returns. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them.
That settling of accounts is inevitable. And the goal, the hope for every believer, is hearing those words.
Well done, good and faithful servant.
You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord.
Being ruler over many things, that's incredible. And the notes highlighted something crucial about the reward itself.
Yes, the five-talent and the two-talent servants, they received the exact same commendation, the same reward.
Which tells us.
It's not about the amount you produce in absolute terms. It's about faithfulness with what you were given. Doubling two talents is just as faithful as doubling five. It's about the effort, the heart, the stewardship at your level.
Which makes the failure of the one-talent man even more tragic. He made excuses. He blamed the master, accused him of being harsh. Bad theology.
Bad theology leads to bad practice. Waiting for the perfect time or thinking God is unreasonable. It stops us cold. It prevents action.
And the outcome for him was stark.
Cast out. Disqualified. The sermon emphasized that God's mercy is vast, but the opportunity to respond to be faithful isn't infinite. We need to get right with him and start producing fruit while we can.
So tying it all together, the unfaithful servant's fear, his busy but fruitless activity, the warning about being ready for the end times, it really forces you to look at your own life.
Are we just busy, or are we genuinely fruitful? The servant digging the hole was busy, but it wasn't work directed by the master. It was self-directed activity, ultimately useless for the kingdom.
Like busy bees, but no honey is being produced. That was the phrase from the notes.
We're called to obey God's commands, use what he's given us for his purposes, not just fill our time with things that feel productive, but don't advance his kingdom.
So if the promise is that faithfulness with the few things here leads to being ruler over many things later, that leaves us with a pretty direct question, doesn't it? A final thought for you listening.
What specific talent, what resource, what opportunity has God given you? And if you're honest, deep down, have you maybe been burying it, hiding it out of fear, or maybe just complacency?
What is that one thing you know you need to start investing, start multiplying today?